just be starting today's class as a continuation of last week. And we'll just stop momentarily. We're going to address the question we left with. We'll do a little recap. So if you weren't with us, we'll just repeat the question that we left with last week. Very intriguing question. Touching on the issue of reward, a little bit about the free will, where it applies, and maybe conclusion of a Passover. And we'll just stop momentarily. How are you?
Well, how are you?
Okay, doing good.
So long, I was on the phone, and someone else just joined, too.
Yeah, that's another thing.
I'm Gary Raines.
Morning, good morning. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning, everybody. How are you?
Fine, how are you?
Okay. Still a little perplexed with our question, but we'll see how we do today. But I think we may have an in. Okay. All right, so let's recap. We have two verses that we're addressing. We're addressing primarily the issue that during the death of the firstborn, so Moses told the people that. And this is in Exodus 11:7. Moses is addressing Paro.
Howard Solomon.
Howard, how are you doing?
How are you doing?
Okay. So we're just repeating what the question was that we had last week. But just for the facts are that in Exodus 11:4 is where Moses addresses Paro, and he tells him that about midnight, God is going to pass to Egypt, and all the firstborns are going to die. From the firstborns of Paro that sit on the throne, to the firstborns of the maidservants that work behind the grinding stone, and all the firstborns of animal. And he goes on to say that there's going to be a great cry in Egypt that never preceded it, and that will never surpass it in the future. Because of this plague, the death of the firstborns. Then Moses says an interesting statement, and he says, "And all of the Jews, there will not be a dog that barks. It will not bark at a man, it will not bark at an animal, in order that you should know that I distinguish between Egypt and between Israel." So that's when Moses is telling them about the event that's going to occur. He's predicting what would happen as well. So of course we want to know what is the necessity of this point that the dogs are not going to bark. Now the verse gives us information, so of course we have to really critique the verse. Well, the way we got to this is that last week we were talking about the Torah readings that we have during the 8 days of Passover. We read the Torah every day. And one of the verses we discussed, that it was a series of verses read on the second day of the intermediary days of Passover. It talks about not cursing a prince and not delaying to give your tithes. And that if you find an animal that was attacked or killed in the field, meaning not through slaughter, but it died some other means, so of course a Jew can't eat that. And the verse says in Exodus 22:30 that you are to be a sanctified people to me, and flesh that you find in the field that is torn, it dies through attack, it doesn't die through slaughter. So this is called trefa, it's torn. So you cannot eat it, the Jew cannot eat it, and you should cast it to your dog. And I'm not sure who asked, I think it was Brad, or I'm not sure who asked the question last week, but there's a Rashi, has a commentary that states, why do you cast it to your dog? What's the need to even mention it? The verse is really for our perfection, that we should not be so bent on instinctual satisfaction that as soon as we find a fresh kill, that our drives, our appetitive drive, should overtake us. So we control that, and we do not eat meat which is not slaughtered a certain way. But instead, we give it to the dog. We give it to our dogs. And the reason being, because of what we first read. And Rashi states that two things. He states that you should be taught, number one, that the dog is more honored than you, in this case, which is interesting, we didn't really take it up last week. What we concentrated on was the second statement, which says, quote, and to also teach you. Why do you give the meat to the dog? The Torah is teaching you that God does not hold back the reward of every single creature, as it states, and to all the Jews, no dog barked. So God says, therefore, give him, the dog, his reward. Okay. So we got both verses. And the question we had initially last week was, what is this concept of giving the meat to your dog as a reward? I mean, the dog has no free will. The dog is not listening to God, and God says don't bark, and he's got intelligence, and he can respond by buttoning his lip and out of a free will decision. The way the dogs didn't bark was a miracle, just like the hailstones came down with fire, and just like the locusts came in swarms at a precise time, and all the rest of the plagues. This is no different. There is no free will in a hailstone. There's also no free will in a dog. It's basically a robot. It functions based on pre-designed and predefined instinctual patterns. And this is demonstrated most clearly when we look at a school of fish that move in such perfect unison. You could have thousands. That how does that work? The reason that happens is because they are functioning with exact duplicate design. So that's why their movements are duplicated. No different with any other animals. Okay, so that was the primary question, was wherein is there the concept of reward applicable to a being that has no free will? Okay, and then we related back. We wanted to see the actual source, so that's why we read the first verse, to see what this idea of the dog's not barking, what was it was in connection with. And again, it's in connection with the actual plague of the firstborns, that while the firstborn from Paro and his maidservants and everybody in Egypt, even to the animals, were dying, not only were no Jewish firstborns dying, but a dog did not even bark at a Jew or an animal, or a Jewish animal. So what is this concept? But what was the need initially for this event, if we want to go in a sequence of the events. What was the need besides God killing the firstborns? I mean, the verse says, and again, this Exodus 11:7, that we already know that the firstborns are being killed, but the verse says, and to all the Jews, a dog did not even wet its tongue, didn't bark from man to animal, in order that you should know that God distinguishes between Egypt and between Israel. I mean, doesn't the plague of the firstborns itself show that God distinguishes between Egypt and Israel? So what was the additional need for the dogs not barking? Okay, everybody has a question?
Rabbi?
Yes.
First of all, there's a lot of background noise, and if people who are just listening and not talking have their phone on mute, it might get rid of that background noise.
Okay. So whoever has a phone that they can put it on mute, please do so.
And then the other thing is, I was reading, and they were talking about how evil people sometimes can, what will have what looks like a disproportionate reward in this world, and I was, and then they won't, you know, they'll be cut off from the world to come. And I was wondering, is with the dogs, are they, is this also being used as a way of showing how a creature of this world is getting rewarded now, even though we know that they won't have anything in the world to come?
Well, you're talking about an animal that... Excuse me? Hello? Okay.
Yes,
I thought
wondering if there's any connection.
Okay. No, there is no connection, because you're making a comparison between... again, if anybody has their mute off, please turn on your mute if at all possible. Because there's a lot of background noise. Okay, the concept of a dog getting reward here and not in the next world is not applicable, because the reward does not even apply to a beast. So you can't talk about how reward works if the whole category is inapplicable. Okay, so that's why it does not, you can't apply that here to a dog. You can apply it to an evil person. That's what Rashi states, and I'm sure many others, that God, of course, will give reward to a person if they did anything properly. And the wicked will get the reward here in order that they don't partake of the next world, which they cannot partake of. So in order that when they die, it's called being matzdik the din, which means that they die and they come before God, and God says, you did X, Y, and Z good things. You had a very good life. You had plenty of riches. And they will have to agree and recognize that God is righteous, and they were the ones that have lost out, which is a tragedy beyond compare, to lose out your eternal life because you wanted to gratify some temporal emotions here. But in terms of a dog has no free will. So we can't say that God is giving a reward to the dog here and not in the next world. Okay?
I was just thinking that maybe the person had put themselves in the same category as the dog, i.e. no chance at all. They've already disqualified themselves because they're so evil.
Well, you can't say it's like a dog, because again, it's a completely different category. It's like saying, you know, the moisture of water is similar to the height of a tall person. I mean, moisture and height don't relate at all, so there could be no comparison. So similarly, there cannot be any comparison between a dog and a person when you're talking about free will.
Thank you.
Okay, no problem.
Hey, guys, maybe it is the dog. The dog has natural thing the dog can do is to bark, right?
Right.
If the dog doesn't bark, that means that his nature that God is behind the plague. So they shouldn't say it from, you know, just from nature.
Well, I mean, the firstborn's dying definitely shows that. What more is needed? Right?
Right.
So the you don't need another...
Maybe this is an added thing to show, in case you don't think it's from... maybe you think it's from nature. I mean, I somewhat can convolute that, but maybe they can. But it's also to show that we're just like the dog won't bark. Then it's also, you know, nature is not running the same way as it usually does.
Yeah, but the way God would work, if a first lesson doesn't function, the second lesson has to be better. Here, you're giving a weaker type of a thing. A dog not barking is not as not as miraculous as all the firstborns dying. Right?
Right. Right.
So again, we have to understand what was the need for God to suspend the barking of the dog. And the verse does say that God was doing this in order to distinguish between the Jews and Egypt. Okay.
Howard, are you for Jesus on a cell phone?
Yes.
Are you on a train?
No.
Okay. Are you able to mute your cell phone?
No. It's the server. I'm just going to get off.
Oh, it's all right. He's trying to diagnose.
Okay. We did notice a correlation, though, between the two. We did see that when... in the verse that we started with last week, that the purpose of not eating the meat when you find it in the field, God says clearly in the verse that you are a sanctified people. So the first step we said is that by restraining from eating this meat that we just found in the field, we're out, we're taking a walk with our family, we're on a picnic or whatever, and then we find this beautiful deer who was just killed. You could take this meat, bring it home, and skin it, and freeze it, and gut it, and it would be fantastic. It would probably be worth thousands of dollars. But no, you can't do this as a Jew. And you can't sit down to eat any of it right now. And really, there's nothing wrong with doing that other than the fact that then you have the command, which is always the case. So, but we see that what it's targeting is not to give in to the instinctual drive for, as soon as they find the meat, the fresh kill, to have that delicious food, that really what we're supposed to do is look at the bigger picture, and we have laws, and meat has to be treated a certain way for the fact that we have to distance ourselves from our instinctual drives and not to just respond to them every single time that they act up. So the real objective of the system is to correct us in all the different facets of how our emotions work. And that's why it says that you are to be a sanctified people, because sanctification comes from the control of the most primary instinctual drives. And the more we can distinguish ourselves and remove ourselves from the instinctual, then we reach a higher level. And it's very interesting that what we're doing is there's a contrast in the verse. I'm just noticing now that we're giving it to the dog. We're letting the dog, a dog is a beast without any intelligence. So we're saying that meat like this, that is just found, instead of just eating it like an animal, no, we'll give it to the animal, we'll give it to our dog, we won't eat it because it's not slaughtered, in order to embody the concept that this type of a lifestyle is a animalistic type of lifestyle. So you giving it to your dog underlines that what the dog is. So I take the meat and I put it in its proper place. I put it with the category of instinctual. So you give it to the dog. The dog is instinctual. And by giving this meat that you just found unslaughtered, you're saying, I am not going to be instinctual. It really belongs to what category? It belongs to the instinctual type of a lifestyle. And what embodies the instinctual? A dog. So by giving it to the dog, we are now, in other words, defining what this type of a lifestyle would be. You see that point? It's like giving a stolen object to a crook. I'm not going to keep a stolen object. I'll give it to a crook, which I'm not saying is what we're supposed to do, but I'm just trying to show how that would be similar. If I want to define the nature of a stolen object, putting it in the hands of a crook now shows its proper place. So putting an animal that is not slaughtered into the mouth of a dog is now showing that really this type of a lifestyle is excuse me, is an instinctual lifestyle. We're trying to part with that and trying to live more in line with our intelligence. Every day that passes, where else can we elevate ourselves to function in accordance with the one element that we have that no other being has, meaning the intelligence? So that's why it states that you are a sanctified people. Okay. So now, what can we say about the verse in Parshas Bo, which is, again, going back to 11:7. Take a look again and see if you can see any correlation. Let's wait a moment. Take a look now at 11:7 and see if you might have an insight based on this. Yes.
It is that God is distinguishing by saying that in a similar way that around Israel, which is at a higher level, the animals will not operate instinctually, to show that my people Israel is not in that camp, unlike the Egyptians, where they will operate instinctually.
So you're trying to say that the dogs are supposed to represent the level of the Jew?
No, it's more about a reflection of I'm showing you that Israel's operating at a different level by the fact that even when the animals get around them that would normally operate instinctually, they won't.
Well, what does the verse say the reasoning was why God held the dogs back from barking? And know that you should know
that God will have differentiated Egypt and Israel.
And know that he differentiates between Egypt and the Jews.
Right.
Okay, so how does that, just in terms of a simple explanation, so how is that being achieved? How is the fact that the dogs don't bark achieving the objective of differentiating between the Egyptians and the Jews?
Rabbi?
Yes, go ahead.
Rabbi, I'm just reading in the commentary on the Chumash in verse 7, it seems that what's being contrasted here, and it's interesting in the verse, it says against all the children of Israel. It specifically says that the dogs will not bark against the children of Israel. It doesn't mean that they won't bark against the Egyptians, but it says that they won't bark against the children of Israel. And in sharp contrast, according to the commentator, it says in the midst of the grief and the death that is encompassing, the Egyptians, the Jews will enjoy complete tranquility, so that not even a dog will bark or howl against them to disrupt that tranquility.
Very good. So that makes sense. That makes sense. That what is going on is the differentiation God is making is on such a level. Not only are the firstborns dying of the Egyptians and not of the Jews, but the Jews have nobody that's dying in their camp, but even more than that, not even a dog is barking, meaning the degree. Not only was the quality of the plague absent in Goshen, where the Jews lived in Egypt, but even more than that, they had complete tranquility. Not even a dog was barking, meaning not only was on the other side, but Egypt, there was every firstborn beast and human died. So now you could say that's sufficient that the Jews didn't experience that. That was something which was offered a certain tranquility. But no, there wasn't any type of a disturbance. Not only was there no plague, but there was also not even a dog barking. They had complete 100% tranquility, which makes sense. And that was a distinction that God saw that was necessary to be made. Question is, why was that necessary? That's what I'd like to focus on at this moment. Right, so take a moment and think about what would be the... You hear the question, right?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Let's just think. Sometimes last week we spent quite an amount of time trying to work out the reward factor. So it's not a simple thing, but we have to think into it a bit. What was needed? It wasn't sufficient that just that there were no deaths on the Jewish side. Something was still missing. And that was taken care of by the dogs not barking.
Rabbi, is it that God, through the firstborn, showed that he had dominion over, if you will, the kingdom of people, and that by doing the thing with the dogs, he also showed that he had dominion over the animal kingdom as well?
Well, you missed the point then. Which firstborns died? You're overlooking an essential fact, because God killed the firstborns of the beasts as well.
Oh, okay. Scratch that.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Could it be that when the Jews were leaving, it had to be as in a victorious situation, not as a group of people that were being booted out, and you're not, if you're being barked at and hounded and in a state of confusion, etc., that does not portray a victorious situation.
It doesn't appear that this was happening as they were leaving. This was happening during the plague of the firstborns. They were still there. They were still there in Egypt.
Yeah, but it was still the prelude, because it was the night before.
Yeah.
And so it set the stage for them leaving in a proper frame of mind.
Just because the dogs aren't barking at me? What's that doing for me?
No, it's giving you making it a festive event. It's pretty hard to be having a festive event when the dogs are howling and barking and carrying on.
Who was it for? The fact that the dogs weren't barking, you're suggesting that was for the Jew. But Moses...
Well, it would be for both. It would give peace and tranquility to the Jews, but it would also show the Egyptians that... their situation.
Well, let's pause for a second and think about, let's say this was directly, because Moses was speaking to Paro at this point. So he was addressing him and telling him that this is going to happen. I mean, it was important for Paro to know that not a dog is going to bark at the Jews. Not at the Jew, and not at the Jewish animal. Think for a moment and see, why was it necessary for Moses to tell that to Paro? Because you're talking about it, which may be truth, that there's some benefit to the Jew. But since he is addressing Paro, why did Paro have to hear this? All right, so let's take it from a different angle right now. Take a few moments to think about this. I mean, this question I didn't have until just now, so it's there may be something. I just want to think about it for a moment myself. Yes, Cal. How are you?
Fine, thanks. I'm going down the path of barking has to do with sound and hearing, and that maybe the barking, the fact that the dogs didn't bark, indicates that even the animals were responsive to God's command, and it's only the Egyptians that did not adhere to the authority of God, and that it's showing that even the animals that are lesser than humans are responding. So why not the Egyptians?
Well, that it would be teaching a foolish idea. That would be teaching that animals have free will again.
Well, that they're all under God.
You're trying to say that if the animals listened, certainly the man should have listened. But that's equating free will to free will. You can only say that. I can say to my students, you know, if Jack listened to me, you know, so why can't John listen to me? That makes sense to say. But I can't say if the dogs listened, then the Egyptians should have, because the dogs aren't listening. They're robots. On top of that, you also had previous plagues with animals, which, interestingly enough, God also talks about in those two, I think by both of those plagues, with the wild beasts that attacked, and also the plague where the livestock was killed. It says there that God, again, distinguished between Egypt and Israel when it came to the animals. Now, of course, there's one layer of import when we talk about the animals vis-a-vis Egypt, because they deified animals. So there was a great breakdown, and when Moses was talking about the sacrifice, he says numerous times, he keeps on repeating over, that that they're going to slaughter, they're going to keep on slaughtering and slaughtering and slaughtering. Why does he keep on saying the word slaughter? Because he wants to emphasize that the animals are not gods, and they have no defense, and if we want to kill them, they will die. And Rosora is suggesting that the plague of the dogs not barking was extraordinary, never happened before, and that was an interruption of natural event. That dogs normally should bark, but they didn't. But to that, I would say that this was no different than any other plague. Normally you should not have fire instead of hailstones. Normally you shouldn't have a man being able to predict when locusts are going to come or any other of the plagues. So I wouldn't say that this is any different than the other plagues in terms of natural. Okay, Rosora. I would suggest one thing, though. It just occurs to me that perhaps when we say that God is distinguishing, if I want to distinguish between... let's say I have two swatches of a fabric. One fabric is black, and another fabric is a dark gray. So I distinguish between them because one is very, very dark. The other one is not. Right? There is some difference. It's a quantitative difference, right? It's just a little bit lighter, but I can see the difference. So that you would say, is a good distinction. Would you agree?
Uh-huh.
Now, what about if I had two swatches of fabric, and one is black, and the other one is white as snow? What would you say about the difference in that second case of fabric as opposed to the first case? What more exists? And let's...
Qualitatively, a completely different color.
Okay.
Not just a case of shade.
Okay. Now, if God is interested in distinguishing, I mean, again, what is the need to distinguish between the Jews and the Egyptians? This question we have to ask as well. Evidently, God was trying to teach them at every turn, right? God was trying to educate the Egyptians. That's why there were so many different plagues with different facets of information, and why Moses would tell Pharaoh, oh, you see the plague of the hail, it broke the stiff plants, but it didn't break the flexible plants, meaning he was showing him another layer of intent, of education with the plagues, that it's supposed to parallel, this plague at least, was paralleling Pharaoh's obstinate personality. Pharaoh, if you're stiff like the stiff plants, you're going to break just like them. But if you show some flexibility, you can save your nation. So the plague said, you know, multifaceted. That's what the rabbis and the Haggadah, I think you may have mentioned it last week, that they say there were 200 plagues, there were 250, if you look through the Haggadah, meaning there were more than just the plagues themselves. There was many aspects of pain and discomfort, and each one was supposed to be giving off a different lesson. So perhaps here as well, when God is distinguishing, of course what he wants to do is show them where they're making a flaw. But that would just be sufficient if I had a black piece of fabric and then a gray piece of fabric. I could show a difference between the two. Meaning the Egyptians are the black fabric, they're very dark and evil, and the Jews are not that dark. So that's one way I could distinguish. But another way I could distinguish is to say, you Egyptians are very evil, but the Jews are very good. That would be akin to the black fabric and the white fabric. I mean, the distinction could be made in just a mere quantitative level, showing different gradations, like you said, Doug. Or you can teach a lesson by showing the two ends of the extreme, where God is not trying to just show them all the flaws that they have, but that the real lesson here is you can't just say you're bad, and that's the lesson. A teacher can't be successful by taking students and saying you're bad. What the teacher must do after that is now show what the optimum state is. And that's what God was trying to do here, I believe, with the dogs not barking. Moses was trying to wake up Pharaoh to the concept that not only you're living corruptly, but you should be looking at the Jews where God is relating to him in a way where he gives them such perfect tranquility because of what they are about to receive, this Torah, this lifestyle, the fact that they're going to destroy the Egyptian belief in animal deification. And they're going to circumcise themselves and remove themselves from the instinctual. So both in terms of the emotional lifestyle, in terms of circumcision, and in terms of the intellectual lifestyle, which means abandoning idolatry, in both spheres, both parts of the human nature, the instincts and the intelligence, the Jews are now living properly. And now I'm going to show that the distinction between them and the Egyptians is not just that the Egyptians are bad, but that the Jew, I'm trying to show you Egyptians, that this is really the optimum that you should target. And look at what happens when you live that way. God can even control the barking of a dog. Look at the tranquility that the Jew is going to have. That's why Moses was addressing Pharaoh. So it could be there was a certain amount of tranquility that the Jews benefited, but you must say that if Moses was telling Pharaoh that the dogs are not going to bark, well, every one of the firstborn on your side of Egypt are going to die, Moses is trying to tell Pharaoh that not only are you corrupt and this is now the end of your civilization and culture because the firstborns as Rabbi Chaid had explained, they were the ones that proliferated the culture. They were the ones that were the leaders, the firstborns. So by killing them off, it ended the continuation of Egyptian culture. So that's one message. But the other message is that what you should recognize as being the optimum in life, and that's the Jew, the one who's following the one God, and we show how perfect that lifestyle is by God even controlling the dogs from barking at them. Okay, so let me just pause here and see if there's any questions. Make sure it's clear.
So you're just trying to make the point that it's about showing Pharaoh how corrupt he was?
No. But also showing, see, when you want to show a distinction, what's the objective of God's plan in distinguishing the Egyptians from the Jews? Not just to show how corrupt you are, but to show you what you should have been doing, to show you the real life that you should have been following. That's portrayed by the Jew. And how do I show Pharaoh that the Jews are favored by God? He doesn't even let a dog bark at them. They're having such tranquility. So, again, the concept of distinguishing has as its goal to put in the person's mind what they really should have gone for, the right life that they should have lived. It's not sufficient to tell a person you're bad. What you must do then is now show them what you should have done. The whole point was to show them the monotheism. If I just tell the Egyptians that your gods are nothing, you're not giving them anything positive. You're just taking away their negative. So what should I have been doing? Oh, so that's why, you see, the Jew portrays that. He's giving him an example of the proper human lifestyle. That's why he was explaining it to Paro that the dogs are not going to bark. What does Paro have to know this for? If it's just for the tranquility of the Jew, good, let God do it. No, if it's not just for the tranquility of the Jew, it's for Paro to gain a new insight that look how God preserves those who live properly. You're going through the most tragic state of affairs that Egypt has ever experienced with the death of the firstborns of the men and the slaves and the animals. And look at the stark contrast, how the dogs aren't even barking with the Jews. Not only are no firstborns dying, but they have complete peace and quiet. There has to be, this is only happening because God favors them. Do you see it? That makes sense? I mean, is the idea clear?
It sounds, Rabbi, too, that just based on what you're saying here, it reminds me of, in a sense, what happens with Havdalah. You know, where there's this distinction between the seventh day and the 6 days that preceded it. It's not just a numerical distinction. I mean, it's something that's qualitative. It's something that's spiritual. It adds to the emphasis that it's, you know, seventh day is Kodesh, and the other 6 days are simply mundane.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's a good association. And Rosura was just asking a question online. She wants to know if a plague was a punishment and dogs not barking was a reward. I would not say it was necessarily a reward that the dogs are not barking. I think, again, it is for the lesson that we're saying, that it would show Paro how God would relate to the Jews in such a positive way. Not only was there no negative in the Jews' camp, but there was a positive state of pure peace and quiet and tranquility. So it's not a reward for the Jew necessarily. So now we understand a little bit more now in terms of this concept of God distinguishing and what goal it targets. And going back now to the law that when you find an animal that was killed not through slaughter, you find it in the field, So giving it to the dog, so what does it mean, reward? That was the original question that we had, right? Well, what does it mean that God does not hold back the reward of every creature? Of course, no reward is due to a beast that has no free will. So one idea we said last week is the concept that the Torah system itself is telling you here in this verse, give the food to your dog. That the Torah system built into it shows you how the commands are complete, they're completely synchronic. They're in sync with the events that took place as God took the Jews out of Egypt. So, thousands of years later, when I'm in the field and I find an animal, I give it to my dog and I don't eat it. Why? Because it causes me to recall why we were leaving Egypt, why we were entitled to leave Egypt. It was because we circumcised ourselves and we destroyed the Egyptian gods. So that one aspect of circumcising ourselves, where we removed ourselves from an instinctual lifestyle, so we reiterate that when we now come across an opportunity today to be instinctual by finding meat that wasn't slaughtered properly, so I could either eat it and I can give in to my instinctual drive, or I could not eat it, give it to the dog, and now that recalls in my mind the event when the dogs didn't bark. It's a way to remind us of that event when the dogs didn't bark. Just like now when I find the meat, I want to remove myself. I want to distinguish myself from, separate myself from an instinctual lifestyle. So I give it to the dog. I don't eat it. So now, why am I giving it to the dog? So Rashi is saying, you're giving it because they didn't bark. So what does that mean? It means it's recalling the event where we deserve to be saved from Egypt and to be taken out, because back then we separated ourselves and we did the act of circumcision and removed ourselves a step from instinctual gratification. So it's a means of reminding us of that. Shatnez, separating wool and linen, not plowing two types of diverse species together. These things as well are for the same method. Ibn Ezra says, Rabbi Chait gave a beautiful class on the purpose of not mixing wool and linen in the clothing. And he quoted Ibn Ezra, who says it's to remind you of the two things in your heart that should not be intermingled. That means it's referring to the instincts and the intelligence. You should not live a life where they're intermingled. You should live purely but intelligently in control, and the intelligence should control the instincts. So not plowing two diverse species, and not mixing, and not crossbreeding, and not wearing wool and linen, are all to recall in the mind that you should keep those two things that are planted in the heart. They should be separate. The intelligence and the emotions should be separate. So we see we have reminders in our day-to-day lifestyle where we are recalling that the instinctual life has to be something which we remove ourselves from, that it's under our control. Yes, there's times when we are to gratify ourselves, like during Passover, and have meat, and to have an enjoyment. We're human beings. We can't live as ascetics or as monks, where we are not satisfying basic needs. But at the same time, it should be under our control. So here also, we find the meat, we don't eat it, we give it to the dog. We remind ourselves, we left Egypt at the time and the dogs were not barking. Why? Because since we lived properly at that point, now God made sure that we had complete tranquility. So that's one lesson. And now we can see why both verses, when Moses told Paro that God is going to distinguish between the Jews and the Egyptians and the dogs won't bark, there it was a purpose of showing a distinction. Here also we are supposed to be a sanctified people. That means distinguished, distinct. So you see the same concept is in both verses. I thought that was a good observation that we made, that we saw a tie-in now between the two verses dealing with the dog not barking. All right, and we're not saying that it's a reward to the dog in the sense that he did something, he listened to God. He can't listen to God. He doesn't have ability, he has no free will, he has no intelligence to hear a concept, let alone to follow the concept. Okay? There's no concept of reward in that respect. So what is the concept of reward here? The God, the Rashi says God does not hold back the reward from any creature. It means that when he created his universe, it was in a way where he takes care of everything. He works it out in a way where everything is functioning properly. And just how he can control the way beasts operate. So he doesn't create a beast, though, that is going to have something against its nature. So he gives it its food. So when you give it, you're now showing that God set up a system where everything is being addressed in terms of what its needs are, which you can speak of as being like reward. But it's not reward in the free will sense. Okay, let's pause over here and see if there's any questions or comments.
How about maybe I'm just slow this morning, but so you're saying that I'm sorry, I'm still not understanding the concept of the reward.
Reward could mean where something fulfilled what you told it to do, like a person, a child. So since you listen, so now you get something. You earn something. But that can't exist by an inanimate object. I can't reward a rock for being heavy and keeping my papers on my desk, right?
Right.
But I could use a rock and build a wall with it, and I could say that that is a reward for the rock, meaning I'm now using it in its best capacity. It's a solid thing. It doesn't deteriorate quickly. So in terms of having a wall that I want to have for a long time, a rock is the perfect element to use, a rock or a brick. So you could say I'm rewarding the rock that I'm giving it its objective. I'm letting it fulfill its objective. But the rock is not an animate thing. But I could use the term reward metaphorically. That it's now being used in the best way. It's being its nature is being incorporated and being utilized for what qualities it has.
In this case, isn't God causing the dog to go against its nature by not barking?
Yes, it is. So now, you giving the meat to the dog, you feeding the dog, meaning you're satisfying its nature. It's an eating thing. It's an eating. It's a being that requires food. So giving the meat to the dog is like putting the rock in the wall. Just like the rock sat on my paper and it functioned according to the way it was designed by God. So also when God closed the mouths of the dogs and it functioned according to the design at that suspended amount of time, that intermediary amount of time, it didn't bark. It followed God's nature. So we give meat to it to recognize that it is something which is functioning in line with God's will. Not because it has free will, but that it's a testament to the fact that God satisfies all things, that they function properly. So they function properly in terms of what he says, do not bark. And then it functions properly when you give the meat to the animal. So in a way, it's a reward that you're underlining the fact that it's functioning perfectly. The system is functioning perfectly, as if it was getting rewarded for something that it did. If you want to think about it more, see if I can say it. Say it better.
I think I understand. Thank you.
All right. Okay. I mean, I was thinking, I couldn't find it. I was a little pressed time-wise this morning. There is another case like this. I believe it's by the Red Sea. that there's a metaphoric discussion that God has with the Red Sea. So I'll see if I can locate it. Maybe we'll do that next week, since it's on the same idea here. And I believe what happened was that God caused a miracle that the sea, after it drowned all the Egyptians, that it regurgitated, so to speak, all the Egyptians, because the Jews perhaps might have said that we're coming out on this side of the sea, and maybe the Egyptians are going out on the other side of the sea, and then we have to fear about them in the future again. In order to calm that fear and eliminate it, actually, so God caused the sea to spit up all the Egyptians so the Jews saw them dead on the seashore. And the purpose was that they would not be able to say that the Egyptians exist anymore. They had to see them dead, finally. That was the end of the Egyptians. So the Talmud, I believe, talks about this in a euphemistic sense. And you have this also when God... there's another Talmudic area where God shrinks the size of the moon. And there's a discussion that God has with the moon. But regarding the sea, so the sea is complaining to God. You just gave me all the Egyptians to swallow, and now you want me to give them back? So God gives the sea its due, since the sea did what God said and followed the miracle of spitting up the Egyptians. So now God gave some reward to the sea. So again, the question is, really, this is the sea is not an animate thing. So what are the rabbis telling us by coining this metaphor and saying that there was this discussion? What is the meaning of that discussion? Similarly, when there's a in the beginning of Genesis, if you want to take a look, it says when God made the two lights, the large and the small one. So why was it small? So Rashi, I think, brings down that originally the sun and the moon were the same size. But the moon went to God and said, how could you have two of us wearing the same crown? We're both the same size. It's like having two kings in one kingdom. We're both equally powerful. Doesn't make sense. One should be greater. The moon evidently wanted to be greater. So God says, you're right. But to the moon's dismay, the moon was the one that was reduced in size. So there's a whole Talmudic area on this where, you know, of course, the moon is inanimate. It can't talk. But what did the rabbis trying to say with this whole discussion? So maybe we'll take this up. Just it'll be good in terms of examining how the rabbis write metaphors, but also in terms of understanding, you know, it's a difficult thing when we talk about an inanimate object that speaks. What is the real idea behind it? So maybe we'll do that for next week. And maybe that'll help us here as well. Sounds good?
Yes.
All right.
Very good.
All right. So if you want, you can take a look. If I find the Talmudic source, I'll send Doug an email. So this way you can all look at it as well. I'll see if I can locate that exact area where it talks about the sea with the complaints. All right. Any other questions? Any other comments?
None here.
No. Okay. All right. All right, so listen, I wish you all a good week. Doug, I'll be in touch if I find anything on that. And I think I omitted to put in the phone number this week in the email that went out. So I'll just try to remind myself that next week we'll do that. But you wanted to first have people email you first, right?
Right.
Okay, so...
That would help. Okay. We'll get them on the list, and then they'll get a notification every week.
Okay, give me the email address you want me to have them send it to.
Kal, K-A-L... at thinkingdynamics.com.
Okay. So I'll put a message in that. We'll send that to next week's notification of the class. All right, very good. This way people know they can dial in. All right, then.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Have yourself a great week.
Bye. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. I'll be in touch.
All right. Take
okay.
care.
Take care. Okay, that'll end today's class. We'll resume next week, same time, 11:15 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So everybody have a good week. If you missed any part of the class, it will be online shortly on the new postings link or the audio link. This way you can listen to the entire class from the beginning. All right, I wish everybody a good week. Take care.